Welcome to Take the Lead Radio with Dr. Diane Hamilton, where she interviews some of the most successful leaders, entrepreneurs, authors, speakers, and other individuals who will inspire you to take the lead in your career and personal life. And now, here is Dr. Diane Hamilton.
Welcome to Take the Lead Radio. This is Dr. Diane Hamilton, and we have a great show today. We have Robert Evans Wilson Jr., aka Rob, who is so much fun. You're going to really enjoy this show. He's an award-winning innovative speaker, direct response copywriter, and storyteller, but he is fascinating. It's almost like having Zig Ziglar in the house, so I'm really looking forward to chatting with Rob, and I hope you stay tuned. We'll be back right after this.
It is essential to determine the things that hold us back from being curious. Think of the most innovative companies, and you will notice they employ people who do not accept the status quo. They look for problems to solve and focus on asking questions. The groundbreaking book, Cracking the Curiosity Code, along with the Curiosity Code Index Assessment, examine the four factors that impact curiosity. Learn how you can improve innovation, engagement, and productivity through improving curiosity. To find out more about this insightful book and assessment, please go to curiositycode.com.
I am here with Robert Evans Wilson Jr., who's an award-winning writer and speaker who works with companies that want to be more competitive through innovation and with people who want to think more creatively. Rob is the author of the internationally syndicated column on innovation, achievement, and leadership, The Uncomfort Zone, which runs in Psychology Today, and more than 300 other publications. He is also the author of four books, including the inspirational book, Wisdom in the Weirdest Places. Well, this is going to be interesting. I've been looking forward to this, Rob.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show, Diane. I'm looking forward to it myself.
Yeah, this is fun. You know, I've been focusing a lot on innovation lately, so you caught my attention. I don't know if you saw, I'm writing a book on curiosity, and part of what I'm trying to do with that is tie in to the importance of engagement, creativity, and, you know, innovation, productivity, all those things. And I think with AI becoming such a hot topic, I think innovation is going to be the buzzword. We're not going to hear anything but innovation for so long. And so you are in the right place at the right time talking about this. So I want to know what the innovator's lifestyle, what is that?
Well, I want to say first, I picked up immediately on the fact that you're writing a book on curiosity, because that is such a big part of innovation. And I like to look at it as the innovator's lifestyle, because that's really so much. There's so much to that, to the innovator's lifestyle. It's a collection of skills and traits and habits, and there's different levels that people can seek. Depending on what they really want. I mean, maybe they just want to be more comfortable with change or more comfortable with risk, or maybe they want to go full hog and be like, you know, a total inventor, you know, someone who's generating new ideas all the time.
Yeah. You know, there's some people who really could be more innovative and creative and all the things that we talk about, but just have kind of not been guided that way. And I think that's what I was trying to do with my assessment, because I looked at the four things that keep people from this, and it's really fear, assumptions, technology, and environment. And a lot of it can be environment if we aren't helped along the way. Do you think that, I mean, you deal with creativity and all these kinds of things that tie into innovation. Can you teach that? Is it something that you just have? I'm just curious where you think about that. Is it a skill?
I do believe it's a skill. Unfortunately, most people do not, and that's part of the socialization process we all go through when we grow up and go to school. We're taught to conform, constantly taught to conform. And you may have heard this before, where people have gone into a kindergarten class and say, "How many artists do we have in the room?" And every kid will raise his hand. Uh-huh. And then 3 years later, they'll go into a third grade classroom and say, "How many artists do we have in here?" And maybe one or two will raise their hand. It happens just that quickly to us. And if you're going to you know, 12 years of school and then maybe to college, and you're constantly told to conform, that by the time we reach adulthood, we've suppressed our natural creative tendencies to the point where most people believe it's a gift that only some people are born with, and that the rest of us just are, we don't have it. But it's not true. It's a skill. And it really is a skill. It's a skill that can be reawakened at any age and really at any time. But it's a critical skill because in today's rapidly changing marketplace, rapidly changing economy, if we're not able to adapt to that change, if we're not able to change with the changes, then we're going to get left behind. We're going to be out of business. And you know, the problem is creative destruction is like a steamroller that's heading right towards every single business. I don't care what it is. It's going to hit you, and it may not hit you in your primary business. I have been hit by the steamroller on marketing. A number of years ago, I had been marketing in one way that had worked fabulously, and suddenly that wasn't available to me anymore, and I didn't see it coming. And then suddenly I had to relearn a lot of new skills. It's a vital skill. And that's what I do believe genuinely. It's a skill, and that anyone can reacquire it.
So how do you reawaken it?
Well, it's...
That's tough, huh? I've been looking into that.
Well, there's so many aspects to it. I mean, there's lots of little things you can do. But to me, it's like beginning to understand what creativity and innovation is all about. And when you can do that, then you're on the right track. Now, I love this quote from Albert Georgi, who was the Nobel Prize-winning scientist who discovered vitamin C. And he once said, "Discovery consists in looking at the same things as everyone else, but thinking something different." And you go, okay, well, that's cool. So I just got to look at the same things as everyone else and think something different. Right. Like, that's easy. I've been looking at the same things all my life, and I've got this real narrow point of view about those things, and I'm not changing, damn it. But here's the thing. This is the trick, and this is what I love about that movie, The Dead Poets Society, that Robin Williams
great
did.
Movie.
Everybody remembers the scene of all the kids standing on their desks,
right?
But most people don't remember where that began. It began when the English teacher, Robin Williams, climbed up on his desk one day, and he asked the classroom, he says, "Why am I standing upon my desk?" And the kids are clueless, so he goes ahead and tells them. He says, "I stand upon my desk to remind myself that we must constantly look at things in different ways." And there it is. There's your key to creativity, your creative thinking, is looking at things in different ways. In other words, getting a different perspective. And that's the key right there, is getting a different perspective on issues. And then that enables you to solve problems better.
Yeah, see, I couldn't agree more. And I think that what I'd like to see, and what I'm trying to do with this, is to let people explore areas they hadn't explored before, because they will have a different perspective because they haven't even explored that area, you know? And I think sometimes we get in these silos where you only know this, and everybody stays in this area, and these people only know this, and they stay in that area. And I'd like to see a little more crossover where you just kind of come in with fresh eyes. Do you think that can be important?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, it's wonderful when you bring in somebody from a different industry to look at your problem. I think there's an excellent story of the head physician at the Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital in London, where they were having a serious problem with patient transfers. When they would transfer a patient from surgery to the intensive care unit, all sorts of problems were occurring. Orders weren't getting transferred, and as a result of that, treatments weren't being given. And that was, you know, a real life-threatening problem, and they couldn't seem to solve it. And then one day, Dr. Goldman, who is that chief physician, is doing his favorite thing on his days off, which is watching car racing. He's watching, you know, Formula One racing. And as he's watching the race, he got really fascinated by the pit crew. because it was just amazing to him that a car would pull into a pit and they would, you know, change the tires, fill up the gas tank, wash the windshield, 10 other things, all in 7 seconds. And then the car's back into the race. He went 7 seconds. They did all of that. It was well organized. It was well coordinated. There were no mistakes. That was the big thing. There were no mistakes. So he goes, I wonder if I could get those people to come in and look at my problem. So he talked to the Ferrari pit crew, and they agreed to come in to his hospital and observe the patient transfer process. And they did this, and then they came back to him with a 3-step process that he implemented, and it reduced the number of problems by 50%.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, and who would think that, right? You know? But that is just an amazing story. And I love stories like that because there's so many people that just assume, that you're because you're in this industry or that industry, it can't cross over, but it's a process, right? So processes can transfer and just the way of thinking in terms of being efficient, right? That's what they were.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's a process to being creative. Mm-hmm. In many ways, a lot of it is that you develop techniques that work for you personally. Like, if you get there's dozens of books on creativity, mm-hmm. but all of them are showing you really how to do one thing, which I mentioned before, and that's getting a different perspective. Mm-hmm. There's just all sorts of different techniques that you can use to stimulate yourself into seeing things in a different way. And I have a simple one I offer most people. I say, when you're faced with a difficult problem and you're having a hard time coming up with some ideas, you're stuck in a groove of this way of thinking you've been doing all along. And I said, you need to break yourself out of that. And I said, one of the simplest ways to do it is instead of focusing on the problem, turn it around 180 degrees and ask yourself, what would I do if the opposite were true? So instead of, okay, I'm freaking out because I don't have enough clients, I'm having trouble finding ways to get new clients, ask yourself, what would you do if you had more clients than you knew what to do with? Now, this isn't going to directly answer your question, but what it does is it pulls you out of that rut. Mm-hmm. It pulls you out of that groove you've been stuck in, and it gets you thinking and looking at it from a different way. What would I do if I had more business and I knew what to do with? Well, I might have to do this. I might have to do that. And then you start thinking in a whole different way, and while you're doing that, that perfect idea just might drop down in front of you.
That's interesting. And I like that because I think sometimes it's almost like getting a song in your head. You got to sing a new song to get the old song out, right?
Especially if it's one that sucks.
Right, especially. But I'm fascinated that you deal with all these ways that people can become more innovative, because I'm trying to develop that as well in people through developing curiosity. And you say there's characteristics of innovators and that there are 3 primary ones. What are those?
Well, the first one to me is the belief that you are creative, that mm-hmm. when you set out to solve a problem or invent something or come up with a new idea, that you will absolutely do it, that you will be successful. And it is this self-belief that innovators have, which really gives them so much persistence. All the people around them will get really irritated or panicked. They'll go, you failed over and over and over again. When are you going to realize you're not going to do this? Uh-huh. And the innovator's like, I am going to do it. And, Thomas Edison famously said when somebody told him, you failed 1,000 times already, why don't you quit? He goes, I have not failed 1,000 times. I have merely found 1,000 ways that do not work.
Yeah, that's a great quote. I love that one.
And so it's that belief that really drives them and makes them so persistent, because they just don't believe they're going to fail. And that actually comes out of the 2 other primary characteristics. And those are, I'll just say them quickly, and then let's maybe get involved in talking about those a little bit, is the ability to take risk. And the other one is that they're open-minded. Mm-hmm. And those two things combined actually fortify that first one. You know, when you've gotten comfortable taking risk, you know, you've been willing to experience a lot of new things because you're open-minded to new opportunities, then that really bolsters that whole self-belief, because you've had opportunities where you have succeeded over and over again because you put yourself out there. You've been a little bit bolder at times, mm-hmm. when you maybe not wanted to be.
Right.
So the second characteristic of risk-taking is really that the innovator is so willing to abandon the traditional ways of doing things and set off in new directions. And they're willing to question authority, question the status quo, ask important questions like, why are we doing things this way? Why don't we try it another way? And they're willing to do these things, and this is a huge part. And so if you're risk-averse, that's something I like to help people get over by taking some baby risks that are not low consequence risks that help them get comfortable with little changes in their life. And if they can get comfortable with little ones, they can start advancing to bigger and bigger ones, to the point where they're so much more comfortable with risk that they're willing to make a bolder step somewhere down the road.
That's really interesting, because some of the things you're talking about, well, the open-mindedness ties into the openness to experience, which is part of the Big Five, which I, of course, dealt with when I was researching curiosity. And the risk-taking and some of the stuff you're talking about, the self-belief, a lot of that is impacted by fear and environment and some of the other factors that were problematic in developing curiosity. And so I think a lot of people don't want to take risks because of their fear of failure, fear of embarrassment, fear of different things. So what are the baby steps? Like, do you have an example?
Well, sure. And just to kind of to build on what you just said, the fear is really what it's all about. Mm-hmm. I mean, people fear change because they're comfortable where they are. And they fear a loss. Now, that's the thing about risk. Mm-hmm. It's not a risk if you don't have something to lose. And it could be, like you said, it could be losing face and that you're embarrassed. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you lose some time. You've wasted some time, or it gets a little higher. You've lost some money.
Yeah.
On this, you know, innovation you want to do, or, you know, you could lose your life depending on what the risk is, you know, so there's mm-hmm. various levels of risk. So I have some little ones I can get people started with, and it almost sounds like no risk at all, but it's making a change, and that's going to make you uncomfortable. And that's where the risk lies, in these low consequent risks. You're going to be uncomfortable by it. So, for example, I tell people, if you drink coffee every morning, switch to tea for the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And people go, oh, what? Not my coffee? Yeah. If you want the same amount of caffeine, you're going to have to drink about 4 or 5 cups of tea.
You're getting your caffeine, so you're not putting yourself into this bad state, but it is a change where you're, okay, I like that.
Yeah, and another one is to listen to a different radio format than you ordinarily do. If you always listen to rock and roll, go listen to classical, or listen to country, or listen to something completely different than you ordinarily listen to, and do it for several weeks, because unless you listen long enough until you start learning some of the music, mm-hmm. you're not really picking up the newness of it. It's just strange at first. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you may find that you start loving the new type of music. I learned to love opera that way. And, you know, so it's fun. It's a fun thing to do, but it's also, you know, you risk not, you know, listening to something you really don't like, you know,
right.
You never know until you get in there.
I think that's really
so
cool.
Those are So those are two real simple ones.
Well, I think that's similar to something that I've suggested. It's just, you know, you get used to reading the newspaper, certain sections, read a different section for a while, read this for a while, read, you know, and there's just
exactly.
So much, yeah. Get you out of that groove, right? You're just, you were talking about being uncomfortable, but the opposite is boring, you know?
Oh, yeah.
To me. And if you get, I think some people they don't realize they're bored sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, that this is, they're just in a rut. And I think that some of it is they need a little nudge, and they probably could be more innovative and just don't realize it. And I think they're going to need to be when jobs are replaced by AI and different things. They can't do more simplistic jobs. They're going to have to be a little bit higher end training and things associated with that. So, I mean, what do you think are the drivers that make people more likely to be innovative?
Well, that's a good question. I might have to think about that for a second.
Well, I guess I'm thinking, I'm trying to direct you, I guess, towards curiosity maybe and making money and different things like that, necessity. I mean, what are the things that you think, like those type of things, are those what you would consider would make, are the times when people be more likely to be innovative?
And you're absolutely correct on that. What's going to, sometimes people are simply forced into being innovative. Mm-hmm. And that's where we hear the old phrase by Plato, necessity is the mother of invention. Mm-hmm. That's when, something breaks and suddenly we've got to fix something with spit and a prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you got some duct tape and WD-40.
Right.
I think that's what those were invented for, those occasions when we're like, oh, crap, what am I going to do now?
Uh-huh.
So there's necessity that those occasions we're forced into it. And then I also like to say, like necessity, there's occasions when we are annoyed into it. We're irritated by things that frustrate us. And I love this quote from Thomas Stenberg, who was who's founded numerous successful businesses, but probably the one most of your listeners have heard of is Staples Office Supply Stores. But Thomas Stenberg once said, I get my best ideas for starting a new business from having been frustrated as a customer. And I thought, wow, that's just really fascinating. That's kind of like a roadmap for finding opportunity.
Right.
Where have you been frustrated? It might be an opportunity right there that to start a new business.
Right.
But, a lot of times it's really the squeaky wheel that gets the oil. When we're annoyed into something, it's something we want to fix.
Mm-hmm.
And so that stimulates creative thinking because we've got to resolve it pretty quickly. It's not something that can be left. So that's a key way in which we're innovative. Of course, curiosity, as you've been studying and mm-hmm. talking about for a while, is a real key way. I mean, we're fascinated by things. It's human nature to always look for a better way of doing things. It's just natural. And I like to point out to people who don't think they're creative at all, I tell them to think about your normal morning routine from the moment you step foot out of bed till you get in the car to drive to work. I said, if you had to recreate all the shortcuts that you have created over the years, every single morning, you never get out of the house.
Yeah.
And we don't realize how often we create little efficiencies in our lives. And it could just be extremely nuanced or simple. And we have so many of those, but they speed up our routines and help us get through life. And we don't realize those are innovations that we have done, little tiny ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so another way I like to point out to people that they've been creative is I'll ask them, I says, okay, I'll bet every one of your listeners has used a paperclip for some other reason than holding papers together.
Uh-huh.
And everybody has. So right there, they have used a paperclip in an innovative way. So, but curiosity is such a cool thing because we're, and I think it's just a natural thing for most people. And I think that as well has been repressed by, being told to conform. It's like, sayings like curiosity killed the cat. Okay, that's basically being told to conform. No, don't be curious. You just do as you're told.
Right,
you do
right.
the way we've always done things. But great things have come out of curiosity, like the microwave oven. Percy Spencer, he's working on the radar and suddenly notices, or when he goes to take his chocolate bar out that he ate daily out of his coat pocket, and it melted. And he went, well, that's never happened before. He goes, I wonder if the radar machine did that. So he goes over and he puts another chocolate bar in front of the radar, and it melts. So then he starts putting food in front of it. He cooks an egg. He cooks some popcorn. And so then he calls up the research and development department. Guys, you got to come up here and see this. But look what the radar's doing to food here, you know?
Yeah.
And so a few months later, they invented the microwave oven. Because radar uses microwaves. And so
that's a great story. I actually have that story in my book, which is funny. But
oh, yeah. And, of course, the first one is called the radar range, the first microwave oven. So
yeah.
I bet you've got wonderful stories of curiosity.
Well, yeah,
that's why
I
can't wait for your book.
These are great. You've written so many articles and everything. I mean, you're in the Psychology Today. So I'm interested in other stories that you have. Do you have, how much had you focused on? I'm just curious, just since I wrote my dissertation on emotional intelligence and I'm looking at its impact on innovation. What's your thought process of how much emotional intelligence impacts innovation?
Well, you know, emotional intelligence is mostly about having empathy and, you know, trying to understand the other person's point of view and what they're feeling, what they're going through. And if you can do that, you know, that's going to help you create something. You know, if you're an inventor and, you know, you have empathy for what your audience needs are, then you're going to create a better product. And sometimes this happens with, you know, customer feedback, you know, or complaints, you know, you made so-and-so and this is what I don't like about it.
Right.
And then you can go back and fix it. But, you know, if you can anticipate that, you know, through your questioning of things or curiosity, then you might come up with some things, or you might need to interview those people, or you might need to go ahead and make the product and listen to what they have to say.
Yeah, it, you know, there's a lot involved in emotional intelligence. Some of it's, you know, interpersonal skills, and some of it's understanding your own emotions as well as those in others. And I think that a lot of people maybe don't know how to read other emotions sometimes, and that leads to fear of what if they suggest something that they're going to be shot down. You know what I mean? And so if you're not able to really pull in and have empathy for how somebody else feels, or be able to read their emotions very well, or have good interpersonal skills, that's all going to tie into what you're willing to share, what you're willing to look into. You know, it's kind of a bunch of pieces to the overall puzzle of just the discovery process in general, don't you think?
Oh, definitely. You mentioned discovery process, and that's something I call when someone's has this powerful desire to solve a problem.
Okay.
And they and that's really what it depends on first. And if you have this powerful desire to solve a problem, and you put some effort into solving it, into coming up with a new solution, and you haven't solved it yet, there's a point where your subconscious mind will take over the process. It will continue working on that problem 24/7. You'll even work on it in your sleep. And so I call this initiating the discovery process by a combination of your desire and putting some effort into solving that. And then what happens is you'll be in a moment of relaxation, and all of a sudden it'll come to you. What the answer will come right to you. Probably the classic example of Archimedes sitting in the bathtub trying to come, you know, he'd been working on this problem of solving the problem of how the king who was given gold mixed with lead had to prove that a bar of gold was pure gold and not mixed with lead. And as he's sitting there in the tub and watching his body weight displace water, he realizes the answer. And of course, they say he screamed Eureka and jumped out of the tub and ran naked through the streets. But But it was that moment of relaxation where all of a sudden all the stresses of the day are gone, and you're just kind of like daydreaming essentially. You know, you're just relaxed, and you're calm, and there's no demands on you in that moment because you're in the tub.
Yeah,
or you know what I always say, you know, go take a bath or go. My favorite is I have an acre of woods where my house is. And I don't really have a lawn, but I have lots of leaves to blow because the stuff always falls out of those trees. Mm-hmm. And that is the most, I find that a great, relaxing, almost meditative thing to do because it's a mindless activity that doesn't require me putting any thought into it. And I walk around blow leaves and I get some of my best ideas while I'm doing that.
That's so funny. I think mindless activities are really good for that. I do similar things, but mine's more like data entry or something really boring. But yeah, I get that. And so what kind of ideas do you come up with when you're doing that?
Well, it's kind of fascinating. I mean, Albert Einstein, now, like I said, this process, you know, once you've initiated, really works 24/7 and actually even when you're asleep. And Albert Einstein had been working on his theory E=mc² for literally years and hadn't really solved it yet. It came to him in a dream. He actually dreamt the answer, the solution. So just another aspect of how that's working. But for your listeners, let me explain it this way. I think this is an analogy that will really bring it, this whole concept home for them then, so that they'll, you know, really get it. Think about the last time you've been in the market for a new car. Now, you've gone out there, you've looked at all the different makes and models, and you finally narrow it down to the one car that you want. You make a decision. That's the car I'm going to buy. Now, up until that point in time, you have not noticed that model on the road. But then as soon as you make that decision, suddenly you see them everywhere. It's like the road is littered with them. And you go, how is this possible? I thought I was being unique. But that's the subconscious mind at work. Uh-huh. The subconscious mind understands your powerful desire. And so it wants to present to you things around you that will help you resolve that. And so that's why this works so well. And it's such a cool thing.
Yeah, I think there's so many people that just could benefit from this. But then if you think about it, the people who really could improve on curiosity or innovation and these things maybe aren't curious enough to ask for help or to look into it. So do you think that this needs to come from like above leadership? Like, you know, we need to change our overall culture of the organization. I mean, if you talk about the workplace and not just outside of the workplace, how do we get the organizations to see the importance of this?
Well, I believe that innovation is going to work all the way down the line. I mean, everybody, like we mentioned before, people are constantly looking for better ways of doing things. They're constantly looking for more efficiencies. You know, little, it may be big. Mm-hmm. In a company, a person's not going to, you know, they might see a better way of doing something, but if they don't feel comfortable mentioning that to anyone, then they're not going to, or if they've mentioned it before and been shot down, they're not going to mention it again if they come across new ways and better ways of doing things. It really has to be a top-down culture that's established and encouraged and rewarded and acknowledged, and a lot of times those things fall apart. Companies want to establish a culture of innovation or a culture of creativity within their companies, and because they realize that maybe just in the back of their minds that destruction is rolling towards them,
right.
and there's really nothing you can do about that except for prepare. But encouraging people to come, you know, offer ideas, it really does take a genuine effort on management's part, because a lot of times true innovations are going to oftentimes go against what the company's main business is. I mean, look at Kodak as a perfect example. Mm-hmm. They invented the digital camera in 1975, And their R&D people took this wonderful new invention to management and said, look what we've come up with. And they went, oh, no, we can't take that to market. Yeah. Don't you realize what our primary business is? We sell film and photographic paper and developing chemicals. Mm-hmm. Why would we shoot ourselves in the foot with this invention? And so they didn't take it to market. And, of course, you know, 8 years later, I think Sony did, you know, and
we know
the rest
how that
is
worked
history.
Out for them, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And it's crazy to me when I hear that story that they're the ones that invented it.
Yeah.
But yet they shied away from it. And so that's a classic example there of how they had people in the company that were allowed to work on innovations. And a lot of there are some companies that do that. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of the big ones you've heard of, Apple and Google and Amazon and Toyota. Toyota encourages. I think they expect people to, you know, offer as many as 100 suggestions a year to how to improve things. And so they have people looking at those and they implement the ones that are available. But a company has to acknowledge that somebody has made a suggestion. They need to reward that. And then if they actually use it, they need to really reward them and, you know, really
right.
publicize.
I see, you know, a hey, lot of companies who don't give enough recognition. They may use it or they may just totally blow it off, but they don't even acknowledge they've even looked at it. You know what I mean? And
yeah, and that's so important.
Well, I'm curious what you think of the Google 20% time thing. You know, I mean, was that a good idea?
That's a lot of time. That's a lot of time. I mean, that's, and I don't know that they let all their employees have 20% of the week in which to put to innovative mm-hmm. thinking or creative thinking, but mm-hmm. I think that's extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
And to have that as a company policy is just astounding, because 20% of the workforce's time, that's a lot.
It is. And I wonder what the right amount of time is and why they would change it, you know, and some of the factors of, you know, if it was successful. I don't know.
Innovation, it does take time. Mm-hmm. It really does take time. And if you don't put the time into it, then it just doesn't happen. And, you know, not all innovation just kind of drops in front of you. It's like I talked about, yeah, you can start that discovery process, but that's only if you're really passionate about it that's mm-hmm. going to work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're at your job and you really don't care,
mm-hmm.
you know, that discovery process is never going to kick in for you, because it is wholly dependent on the level of your desire.
Right.
And then your subconscious will work on it 24/7. But if you don't have that desire, then it's not going to happen that way. So innovation takes time. And there's a saying, and I forgot who said it right now. It was like this one writer said, a writer's wife will never understand why he's staring out the window and that he's actually working, or something like that.
That's great. Well, it's so true. You know, you've got this on your mind all the time. And I'm thinking about, you know, the Google giving people time to work on certain things. And I was trying to think about that in my research. You know, do we suggest that that's such a good idea, or do you suggest more to be innovative that, you know, you have more team based, everybody gets together and shares ideas that are, you know, I mean, there's so many ways to go about this. And I know you're really passionate about this. So why are you so passionate? What made you so interested in this? Because I know I'm really interested in this and we have that in common. So what led to your interest in this?
Well, you know, I have just found that there's several things to it. So whenever I'm fully enmeshed in the creative process, that is the most fulfilling time I ever spend. It's the most joyful, the most satisfying time spent, and I want to share that with people. But on top of that, you know, you just get more out of life. I mean, the more you develop this, what I call the innovator's lifestyle, and start taking on some of these habits, taking on some of these traits, I just feel like people are going to get a whole lot more out of life. They're going to recognize opportunities that they've never recognized before. They're going to solve problems faster than before. They're going to adapt to change easier. I see just so many benefits to this uh, in and look and trying to constantly look for patterns, look for connections. You know, sometimes it's just fun to like, you know, what, I wonder what would happen if I put this coffee cup and this ballpoint pen together. What could I, how could I do that? And you know, there are people that do this. That's how that some of those really silly,
oh, the videos,
products that would come out at Christmas time.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I remember two in particular, the salad shooter.
Oh,
it was like this machine gun that where you put, you, instead of putting a cartridge of bullets into it, you'd shove a zucchini or a cucumber down the slot and you pull the trigger and it would slice it and shoot out the slices and you have to point it at the plate and hit the plate with these slices of cucumber shooting at her. And I said, okay, somebody was, I want to know what they were taking before they sat down for that innovation session.
It does make you wonder. And so how about the pet rock and just weird things, you know, the things that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, okay. I wonder if they're just laughing all the way to the bank on some of them or, you know, I mean, that didn't take too much innovation to come up with that one.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Definitely the pet rock. Somebody was really having a good laugh on that one.
Well, it's, you must see some really interesting ideas. I mean, when you're writing for Psychology Today and you're writing for all these things, I mean, you speak to top companies, AT&T, IBM. I mean, the list goes on of the companies where you speak, and you've written this book, Wisdom in the Weirdest Places. So you're just looking at this in so many different directions. I'm curious. I mean, you're a top speaker too, so and I can see why. I feel the Zig Ziglar vibe coming off of you. You've got that enthusiasm, and I love that. And that's how did you? Have you always been enthusiastic? Have you always been the guy that likes to learn these stories? Because you're a great storyteller, and just curious where that came from.
Well, you know, I guess I've been a storyteller since I was a kid. I realized that I wanted to be a writer as early as third grade. Mm-hmm. And I remember one point after a particularly good sermon from my minister when I was growing up in the Methodist church, saying to my mother after church, I said, oh, I want to be a minister. And she looks at me and says, oh, and like, you know, she's so excited.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, I didn't realize that you had to do all that Bible study. And, you know, all I really wanted to do was get up and tell fun stories and jokes, because that's what he was doing. He was telling these awesome stories and he was telling these funny jokes. And I was just absolutely enthralled with listening to him.
Uh-huh.
And all the rest of the part of church I really didn't care for. And so, you know, when I realized that, you know, I said, well, no, that's not really what I want. What I want is to tell stories.
Uh-huh.
And so as I went into high school and in college, I found that I would just love to tell jokes to groups of people. And it's just something that I've always enjoyed. And there's nothing to me more fun than sharing a good story with someone.
And you shared some really interesting ones here. I'm curious if you had any others from your Wisdom in the Weirdest Places that just, or in any of your other writing that you just stood out to you as just like, man, this just was a story I couldn't help but be drawn to about innovation or creativity or is there anything else that stands out in your mind that you just go, wow, that was an interesting story?
Well, I'll tell you one that I don't know why this one popped into my head, but I'll share this one. And it's kind of a good example of why you need to be open-minded and try new things and experience new things. And we really haven't talked about that a whole lot. So let me just touch on that briefly before I tell you the story.
Okay.
It's important to experience new things. This is a key, a really important part of being an innovator, because the more you experience new things, you literally lay down new neural connections in your brain. You literally create new electrical connections between the brain cells. In other words, you're building up more data in your brain. And so that gives you more to draw on when you're trying to come up with an idea. Now, understanding that an idea is when you take two or more existing concepts and you kind of meld that or combine that into creating something new. And so that's why that's so important. So, and the other thing about all these new experiences, as you're strengthening your brain, and that's literally what you're doing by doing this, when you create those new electrical connections in your brain, you are less likely to suffer from Alzheimer's and senility as you get older. Because here's what happens. As you get older and brain cells die, you lose one electrical connection for each of those brain cells that's gone. And if you have enough electrical connections between the brain cells in your brain will rewire itself and you won't lose those memories. Otherwise, if you lose like a, you know, a bunch of brain cells and you've lost that memory. But if you have enough of those connections, then you don't lose it. And so that's what makes it a very important, healthy thing to do, to, you know, go out and experience new things. But also, I like to say it improves your sex life, because if you are going out with your partner, your significant other, and experiencing new things, it rekindles those romantic feelings, because it stimulates your dopamine receptors, just like it did when you first met that person, when you just couldn't wait to hop in the sack. And then now you're out experiencing new things, you're triggering your dopamine receptors with that person, and it rekindles and reminds you of those romantic feelings you have for that person. So it's a just so many wonderful things that happen from being embracing the innovator's lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, I could see, I love your enthusiasm, and I could see you were proclaimed the second funniest person in Georgia by Toastmasters. Well, who was the funniest? Were you like in a contest? I mean, what was that all about?
It was a contest, and the funniest person is Jim. Oh, shit, what's his last name? he was pretty funny too. It was the statewide contest for the humor speaking contest, and I placed second. And when I actually had it videoed, and he was this was back in 1997, and he was actually a little more poised on the platform than I was. My nervous energy was spilling over, and you could tell it. I mean, it was funny, but it's, you know, I couldn't contain it. I mean, I was up there on that platform, and I was just so full of energy. And he got up there, and he was so cool, calm, and collected. And that's why he won, and he absolutely deserved to win.
Well, I kind of like the energy, though. That's the little Robin Williams-like. There's nothing wrong with it. But you're also known as the graffiti guy. I'm looking at the – I could talk to you all day. You're interesting. I mean, you've got – you were the author of Off the Wall, the best graffiti of the walls of – off the walls of America. So that's a, what, illustrated collection of witticisms? Did you –
It's an illustrated collection of bathroom graffiti.
Ah.
And there's a funny story behind that if you want to hear it.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Well, this all started back in college. And I was coming out of one of my classrooms one day, and I noticed down the hall a good friend of mine, and he was doing something. And so I walked down the hall to see what he was up to. And as I got closer, I realized he was working with one of those old-fashioned label makers, those pistol grip label makers. So I'm watching him. I said, "So, hey, Ken, what are you up to?" And he goes, "Oh, I'm putting the room numbers on the doors in Braille for the dean. He wants to make it easier for the blind students to find their classrooms." And so I'm watching, and well, I went to Georgia State University, which is a downtown urban campus in Atlanta. All the buildings are clustered close together. And so there were a lot of blind students that went there when I was in school. And I don't know if the reason was because it was relatively easy to navigate because all the buildings were close together. But I'd gotten to know a couple of the blind students. And so as I'm watching Ken, well, all I can say is the devil got into me. And I said, "Ken, does that label maker do more than the numbers? Does it also do the alphabet?" He goes, "Oh, yeah, it does the whole alphabet in Braille." And I said, "Excellent, excellent. Let's take that over to the student center men's room. Let's put some graffiti up in Braille."
Oh, how funny.
And so, And so we did. And the next day I made a point of running into one of my blind friends and I remember saying to Jimmy, I said, "Hey, Jimmy, have you been keeping up with the graffiti people are putting up in the student center men's room?" And he gets this real annoyed look on his face. He goes, "Now, Rob, why are you asking me that? You know, I can't see it." I said, "Well, next time you're in there, why don't you just feel above the toilet paper dispenser?" And he did. And within 48 hours, every blind student on campus had heard about it, and they were after us to put up some more.
Oh, okay.
They said, "This stuff is great." Yeah. Ken and I weren't intending to be the PC graffiti artists of Georgia State University, but we felt obligated to go put up some more. So we needed more material, so we hit the bars for some inspiration. And we found this one really old bar in Atlanta where there must have been 50 years worth of graffiti that had never been painted over.
So
over a couple of pitchers of beer, we wrote down a page or two's worth of graffiti to take back to school with us. And as we looked at all that graffiti written on paper, it just occurred to us, and this was probably the beer talking, but we went, "Why don't we just keep collecting this until we have enough for a book?"
Yeah, that's great.
Little did we know it would take 15 years to get enough material.
I mean, it's great, though. I gotta say that.
It's a fun book.
I bet it is. And everything you do is really fascinating to me. And I think you mentioned you went to that college. What did you get your degree in? I'm just curious.
Well, I got my degree in a major in philosophy with a minor in psychology. I started out as a double major and just, you know, that was good enough. I wanted to get out of school.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, I think you've done an amazing job with all of your work. I mean, it was really interesting to me. All your stories, I could see why you would do so well for so long in Psychology Today and all those other 300 or more publications. I mean, wow. So I think a lot of people will probably want to know more about how they could probably book you as a speaker, because I know you do that, but how they could find your books and all that kind of thing. Can you share how they could find you?
Well, probably the easiest way to find me is to, well, go to my website. It's robwilsonspeaker.com. Or if you can remember my full name, Google Robert Evans Wilson Jr., and you'll see everything about me there. My column for Psychology Today is called The Main Ingredient. And I'll, you know, go to my Amazon page. You can find that again by, you know, putting in my full name. That's the problem with a common name like Robert Wilson. It's like finding a needle in a haystack. And so I always encourage people to remember, if you can remember, you know, my middle name, Evans, you'll find me.
Okay. Now your website, it's called The Main Ingredient. What's The Uncomfort Zone?
The Uncomfort Zone is the title it runs under everywhere else.
I see.
So in most of the 300 publications, it is The Uncomfort Zone, and it's slightly different for Psychology Today, and so we gave it a different name, and sometimes the articles will be, you know, slightly different.
So I
will sometimes tailor it for a particular publication.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's awesome. Well, I really found everything that you said really helpful to all the work that I'm doing, and I think a lot of people can benefit from all your research and all your studies that you've incorporated. I love all the stories. They're wonderful. And I some of them I actually have included in my book, because we look like we researched a similar thing. So I think that those are some of the greatest examples of why innovation is so important, why curiosity is so important. So I really want to thank you for being my guest today. This was fascinating.
Well, thank you, Diana. It's been a real pleasure, and I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, you're welcome. And we'll be back right after this message.
Attend any corporate summit, and it's likely someone will bring up issues with millennials or other generational conflict. In the book, It's Not You, It's Your Personality, the authors explore the post-boomer generations and how to use personality assessments to get along in the modern workplace. Learn what makes the younger workforce unique. Filled with tips, tricks, and techniques, it's not you, it's your personality. Outlines various scenarios with different personalities to give you a more detailed look at how different people can more effectively work together, both in team situations and when various activities require them to better understand one another. You'll learn how to recognize character traits in others, as well as in yourself, and what to do about the traits that need help. Entertaining as well as educational, it's not you, it's your personality, makes understanding personality assessment essential to workplace success. To get your copy, text the word Diane, D-I-A-N-E, to 38470. That's Diane, D-I-A-N-E, at 38470.
Robots, self-driving transportation, and a dynamically connected cross-cultural virtual world will define the workplace of tomorrow. However, education today is mainly focused on technical learning and standardized testing. Is this preparing kids for future leadership? Unfortunately, not so much. That's why LeaderKid Academy offers programs based on the persona model and focuses on developing emotional intelligence, project management, change management, mindfulness, assertiveness, ethical leadership, resilience, creativity and innovation, and presentation skills. LeaderKid Academy offers educator mentoring and training workshops, after-school programs, and ongoing sessions. Unleash the leader in your kid. To learn more, visit leaderkid.org. That's LeaderKid.org. Well, I want to thank Rob for being my guest. This was a fascinating show, and it ties in so well to what I'm researching for the book I've written, Cracking the Curiosity Code. So basically, it's Cracking the Curiosity Code, the Key to Improving Human Potential. And the book goes along with the Cracking the Curiosity Code assessment, which is called the Curiosity Code Index. And so the CCI is an assessment that will help you determine the four factors, fear, assumption, technology, and environment, how much those four factors have impacted your level of curiosity, and gives you an action plan and summary of different things you can do to improve in those areas. So all of this is what is coming out soon, we're hoping by the end of the year. You can go to curiositycode.com to get notified of when the book comes out, and you'll be able to take the assessment there. And you can find out more if you're a consultant or an HR professional. We're doing training and certification programs for to get you all up to date and be a CCI certified dealer. So basically, all the information is on my site for that. And as far as the radio show, you can find past episodes at drdianehamiltonradio.com. If you'd like to listen to the show, you can go to drdianehamilton.com/blog, where all the shows are transcribed, which is kind of nice because you can get links to all the things we talked about. And I know in today's show, Rob listed some things that will be linked to, and all the shows do that. So it's really very helpful. And if you have any comments, you can contact me through the show if you're interested in not only the book and the assessment or anything else. My speaking and my consulting, everything is all available at drdianehamilton.com. So if you missed anything, please check it out there. And I hope you join us for the next episode of Take the Lead Radio. You've been listening to Take the Lead with Dr. Diane Hamilton on C-Suite Radio.